My name is Clancy Immersel, and I'm an alcoholic. Someone was saying to me earlier today that I had a reputation of being kind of a hard-nosed guy or kind of tough, and that's not true. I was thinking about that this afternoon. I'm really kind of a big cream puff inside, and I was thinking, if the doctor told me I had one day more to live, you know what I'd do? I'd catch a plane, and I'd fly to Port Angeles, Washington, and I'd ask Calvin to read what he read today. It would make that last day seem like forever. Well, I'm not your fault, Calvin, their fault. Anyway, as AA continues to flourish around the world, it's made up of human beings, and human beings, of course, have a tendency to be human. And there's some items that come up in the item. I travel around quite a bit in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've heard it. Started a little bit in about 1970. There's something about decimal birthdays, 70, 75, 80, that make people think maybe we ought to look into things, and came up a little bit in 70. And as I'm sure it's coming up, I heard a little trace of it beginning now for the 1975, I mean for our 75th anniversary, which is next year. And it kind of boils down to three or four items that people are talking about a lot. One is that that maybe AA has outgrown its need to maintain that you must be an alcoholic to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Today in the world, with so many more young people, so on, who are on drugs, have the same needs and desperate reasons to come someplace, and we turn them away because they're not alcoholics. Maybe it's time that we got rid of that apparently outgrown philosophy. And there's also another wave of little emotion about changing the book. Big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, nice book, but it's really written in 1930s style. It's not written for you, the young people coming in today. They feel no vibrancy from it. Another one that is really seems to be taking place in a lot of places, get rid of the Lord's Prayer. It offends people. It's a Christian prayer. In fact, I understand that recently at the World Service meeting in New York, they start closing the meetings with these Serenity Prayers. They do instead of the Lord's Prayer. I sponsored a couple of delegates, and they were quite shocked to hear about that. And the last one, of course, is that anonymity certainly was necessary to shield people in 1938, but it's not necessary to shield people now because it's almost a mark of distinction to be a functioning member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we have no need to hide our light under a bushel. And these, I guess, are the four most prominent desires by people to change Alcoholics Anonymous. So I want to discuss them one by one. For example, now, this idea of having to be an alcoholic and to be an Alcoholics Anonymous, isn't that kind of out of date, wouldn't you think? And once upon a time, it maybe was necessary, but today it's not, it's really not required. So we have to wonder, why did we ever have that? Why does that take place in our traditions? Why is that such an important thing? And the thing to understand that, most of us have to go back and study the nature of why we are here. You know, there seem to be two major types of alcoholics, at least, probably more, but two major types. One, apparently an alcoholic, he drinks and gets in trouble and can't get over it, and something happens that really threatens his security. Maybe he loses a job or a family or somebody dies, and he quits, and he never drinks again. And I know several people like that who have done that. And the same type of people, if they've become physically addicted to alcohol, we don't ever hear much about that. We hear about narcotics addiction. But I'll tell you something, the physical addiction to alcohol is much more fatal than drug addiction. When you withdraw from a drug addiction, you get awfully sick. When you withdraw from an alcohol addiction, you sometimes die because you're smashing your head into the sidewalk. But these are the people for whom treatment centers were originally created. Take people who can't stop drinking, and step by step, medically withdraw them. They have to be medically withdrawn and give them information of why they're there, and they come out finally and they've learned their lesson and they quit and they never drink again. In fact, down in Chic Chez Dell, most of you know Chic Chez Dell, where they do what they say they're going to do. They take alcoholics and they cure them in 30 days with a couple follow-up meetings. We say, how could that be done? Because they're working with the type of alcoholic that can be stopped. Then there's another type of alcoholic, which most of us are familiar with, who seem to be alcoholic by any way you measure them. They drink and get in trouble and can't quit and so on. Something happens that really threatens their security. Maybe they lose a job, lose a family, somebody dies, and they quit. But they always eventually drink again. And these same type of people come out of treatment centers with tears of sincerity rolling down their cheeks. I've learned my lesson, thank you, they mean it. But they eventually drink again. And these are the type of people that have baffled humanity for written records of 4,000 years. I mean, how could these people be like this? At one time, they thought they must be possessed by devils. They put them to death, and they flogged them and sent them away and whipped them and put them in bad places. And I'll tell you how long it lasted. When I was a little boy up in Wisconsin, I'm old, but I'm not 4,000 years old. When I was a little boy, they still had never found an answer for this type of alcoholic. The closest thing they had was the Keeley cure, where they gave people booze with drugs in it that made them sick. And then they cured him because they said, you want another drink? No, I don't think I do. Until they found a bar where they didn't have any drugs in the booze, you know. Well, may I try one of those? Shit, yes. Yeah. But there never was an answer. That's what makes Alcoholics Anonymous such an anonymous, such a remarkable thing. It dealt with something that had never been handled before. And it, in a special way. You know, there was, when AA was about, 7 or 8 years old, Alcoholics Anonymous started dying. It was dying little by little. Bill was getting letters every day, our groups died and so on. And he didn't know what to make of it. By late 1944, early 45, in an effort to save AA, he created the Grapevine, made it as a kind of a big thing, and that helped a little, not much. And he didn't know what was causing AA to die. And a doctor in North Carolina sent in an article for the Grapevine. Says, Bill, maybe have you ever read about this? And Bill read this article. And it talked about six drunks in Baltimore, Maryland, one in 1840. One just got out of jail again, and he goes back to his friends and says, Jesus, you know, that chaplain down there says he understands how I feel. He doesn't know how I feel. You guys are the only guy who knows how I feel, and you guys are drinking too. Well, maybe we can help each other stay sober. So they made up a little constitution. They elected officers. They had five officers and one member. And who do you identify with? You know, but everybody laughed. These drunken bums, they can't, you know. But when one would feel like drinking, the other five would get around them and talk to them and so on. And they stayed sober, much to their surprise. They got a few other people to join them. And some guys came down from Philadelphia and joined them. Found out how to do it, took it back to Philadelphia. Some people come up from Washington. And we got something going here. So nobody ever heard of drunkards helping drunkards stay sober. And so we're like the first of our kind. So they named themselves after another first of his kind, George Washington, called themselves the Washingtonian Society. And at the end of a few months, they had a rather large group in Boston, a group in New York, and people couldn't understand this. At the end of the year, they had several hundred sober drunkards of this type that nobody ever could sober up before. They got into the second year. They took Washington's birthday as their anniversary, although it really was about a week off, but it's close enough. And they wrote to all their chapters they could find, by this time, many states, and said, on February 22nd, have a special meeting and have people come in from outside, some young, dynamic opinion maker in your community. Not that we care what they're going to say, but we want them to see we're not crackpots, we're not crazy people, we're doing something good here. So all over the country, February 22nd, 1842, people came in, and Springfield was a young guy named Abraham Lincoln. If you read a book of Lincoln's speeches, you'll read his speech to the Washingtonians, February 22nd, 18, and most of it was just usual talk. But near the end, he said something rather germane. He said, you know, I know all you men in Springfield, and we work together, and I understand your ability, but I have never understood your terrible thirst. And I'm so glad that you are able to quell that thirst at last. And it really grew. The only entertainment that was available much for people on a wholesale basis then, there was no television, no radio, no, not very poor theater, but they'd have speakers go around and they'd have mass meetings and they could talk on subjects and people would turn out for it. And they got a couple of these speakers into the Oxford group, I mean the Washingtonians, and they began recruiting members. And they just plied in because nobody had any answer before this ever. By 1845, it was estimated, they had almost 100,000 sober drunkards in the United States. And it was unbelievable. And the leaders of the Washingtonians got together because it seemed quite obvious to them, as it does to some people in AA today. My gosh, if we're able to help drunkards, we should be able to help all sorts of people. People who have a narcotic problem, not heroin and cocaine like today, but laudanum and opium as they used in those days. We should get involved in politics and make sure that the government runs right. We should get involved maybe in getting Texas into the Union. Maybe we should get engaged in the anti-slavery movement. And everybody took up a cause. They went out and they put their will and their hearts into it. And by 1848, the Washingtonians were extinct and they all died drunk. Very few exceptions. I have a book home written by one of the few survivors in 1861. He said, we were doing so well, but people just got too busy. So many things, they didn't even have time to help a man that was drinking. And they became extinct, so extinct that Bill Wilson had never heard of him. Nobody else had ever heard of him, except his doctor. And Bill saw that, and he ran the article in the Grapevine, and he said, they had a lot of problems. They had problems. He read about the Washingtonians, how their problems with ego, their leaders were fighting amongst themselves. And they were fighting about who should get the profits from their meetings and who should be a member and so on. And in a last gasp effort to save AA and using the Washingtonians as his hallmark, he sat down in 1945 and wrote the 12 Traditions. For those of you who knew, it didn't come out when the book came out. It didn't come out when the steps came out. It came out much later, after many more thousands of alcoholics had died. And he introduced them one by one in the long form in his new Grapevine. And of course, as I mentioned, we were having a lunch earlier today, and I said, told him that we had a problem then, we have a problem now. AA is full of bad type of people. They're full of alcoholics. And a lot of people didn't want them. We don't want any damn rules! We're here to find love, goddammit! You hear me? You know. And they fought against it. Bill would hop in his motorcycle, and put Lois in the sidecar, drive around to meetings, trying to explain these are not rules; they're things to save us. And it got to a point. I read a letter, an interesting letter in our archives in New York, from somebody, a little group up somewhere in northern New York, saying, "We want you to come and speak at our anniversary meeting, Bill. But only if you promise not to talk about the traditions. We don't want them here." Which sounds funny, but it wasn't funny at all. It was tragic. And as a result of that, they got some inroads, but not enough. And Dr. Bob and Bill were quite troubled. They thought if we could just get the people together somewhere and explain this to them, that these are not rules, we're not trying to enforce anything, we're trying to save A. So through a series of machinations, they established a meeting in Cleveland, Ohio, and they invited people from Los Angeles and Miami and Houston and Dallas and Seattle and Portland and all the places they knew where they had A groups. They came, and in the July of 1950, the largest group of sober alcoholics, not in the Washingtonians ever, whoever gathered in the world at that time, and they had a meeting. And I have the tapes of that weekend. The quality is terrible, but the quantity is excellent. I mean, the speak is good. And even then, they still were not quite certain how AA was going over, so they had a lot of non-alcoholic speakers. They had the warden of San Quentin and social workers and so on. But Bill and Dr. Bob talked, and Bill gave a good talk, and Dr. Bob was dying of cancer at that time. And so they said, "You probably don't want to talk, Bob." He said, "Oh, yes, I do. I've got 15 years sobriety. I got the second oldest sobriety in the world." So that day, I don't know how you find funny in that, but check your mirror. Maybe that's what's making you funny. His son And a friend took this tall, gaunt, dying man to the podium, and he gave a talk, and which has come down in history as many people consider to be the Gettysburg Address of Alcoholics Anonymous. It starts off not very dramatic. He says, "I want to thank you all. I'm glad all of you boys and girls from here go back, tell your groups that we're all doing the same thing, trying to get the same actions done." He says, "I want to apologize for my health. I've been in bed most of the past few months. I hope it'll get better." He said, "So I look over this vast crowd. I'm glad there's something I did a few years ago that helped bring this about." And, you know, just usual trouble. But then he said, "I do think I'd like to call to your attention two or three things that might be of interest." And he was the great transmitter of AA, better than Bill Wilson. He was a much better 12-stepper. Everyone got sober in Ohio went through Dr. Bob. And he was so desperate to communicate what he believed. And he knew he was dying, so it was kind of like a deathbed admonition. And he said, "First, let us remember to keep our program simple. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian things that may be of interest to the scientists, but have nothing to do with our work here. When reduced to the last, our work here consists of love and service. And we all know what love is, and we all know what service is. And secondly," he said, "let us guard that erring member, the tongue, and try to use it with kindness and understanding. And there isn't a person in this room or any room like it who doesn't know exactly what he was talking about. We're all very wonderful when things are going our way. Program works, baby. Just love is the answer. But let somebody hurt our feelings." She said, "What about me, that bitch?" And you may even put the world's worst opprobrium that you can say about anybody here. "I don't even think he's alcoholic." God, we fight the title alcoholic our lives, and now we say the worst thing you can say about someone, "You're not an alcoholic." "Yes, I am. I can prove I am, goddammit." Yep. And finally, he said, "None of us would be here today if someone hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, to take us to a few meetings, to give us a pat on the back when we needed it. Let us never reach that stage of smug complacency when we are too busy to help our fellow suffer in this blackness of alcoholic despair." And he died, and was short, deadly short. He sat down and was dead shortly thereafter. But that speech is so impressive. It was on the wall of the General Service Office in New York. Actually, when you get off the elevator, you see it there. But also at that convention, they had six young guys, each who took two traditions and explained it. They were not rules, in the long form. Let's remember, the AA traditions were written in the long form. Some of you may never have heard of them. They're in the back of the book, across from the short form. They're a little bit longer, but... They really, in my group in Los Angeles, we read them the second Wednesday of every month because we want the newcomers to understand what they're about. It's so easy to misinterpret the abbreviations. But they said, "These are not rules. We can't enforce them. We have no AA police." Some of us think that might have been wrong. In my community, there are a couple, two, three people in this room who I have sponsored, and some people have had the temerity to say that I'm a dictator-type sponsor. I do not share. I tell people what to do. Well, it's for their own good. But what they don't realize is that dictatorship is based on the absolute approval of the dictatee. All he ever has to say is, "Screw you," and the dictatorship is over. And I think it would be nice if we had people who could come at night and say, "Did you say screw you to your sponsor? Come with us to the camp." But they don't want to do that. But so they, at the end, they read all these traditions, and I don't know who these guys were, but you could just see their tails wagging on the tape. At the end of the reading, Bill Wilson, still not sure that this much-needed advice of the alcoholic traditions would be accepted, said on the tape, "You have now heard the traditions read. Seeing no objections, they're here. And they saved AA. But in those traditions, one of the things they put in most prominently was that, one of the arguments they use in AA today, some of the groups, they say, it says the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. I have a desire to stop drinking. You can't keep me out. I'm not an alcoholic, never was an alcoholic, never will be. But I have a desire to stop drinking, so I have a say in everything that goes on. And people always say, what can we do about this? It's very easy. You look at the long form of that same tradition. It said, we want to help all those who suffer from alcoholism. When they abbreviated it, they had no idea that someday in the future, non-alcoholics would try to sneak into AA. Christ, you can't get alcoholics in. Why would non-alcoholics want to go, you know? But why is that such an important thing? Why is our message to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers? What is there in Alcoholics Anonymous that makes it so necessary for that? And it boils down to this. There is nothing new in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have found a lot of stuff in other literature that AA is based on, some old literature. And it's not, there's nothing really uncommon about it. The one thing that has made Alcoholics Anonymous work is that it deals with the primary problem of alcoholics. What is our primary problem? What is it we all have in common when we come here? We all know that our case is different. I know you mean well, but my case is different. And unless you break that, he is doomed to die drunk. How do you get through that? Psychologists never been able to do it. Psychiatrists can't get through it. Friends can't get through it. What got through it the first time? You know, when Bill Wilson first got the Oxford group, he began helping people, taking them home, taking them to Oxford group meetings. I think about that sometimes. The Oxford group at that time was made up of well-to-do people sitting in private homes discussing spiritual values. And he'd bring in some street drunk, sit there, just see some nice lady. I believe you're vomiting on my shoe, sir. Yeah. But nobody ever stayed sober. In fact, he was ready to quit after 6 months. He got up one morning, and the guy he'd brought home the night before left early, stole some stuff out of the house to sell for wine, apparently. And he watched his wife putting on her little tattered sweater with a patch on the sleeve, not tattered, but a patch on the sleeve, who'd been a little society girl remarried, now old before her time, gray hair, getting old before time, to go to work at a cheap department store where she's trying to make enough money to keep them both going so he could try to help others. And he turned to her and he said, Lois, I see now I've made a terrible mistake. When I had that experience in the hospital, I thought I was having some spiritual thing, but I realized it wasn't. I've been working with people for 6 months. Nobody stayed sober. It's ridiculous, and you've had to go to work every day and try to support me. He says, I'm going to get a job, Lois. It's going to be different. It's going to be all right, darling. I'm going to quit all this crap. And right there, your life and mine hung by a thread so thin you can't even measure it. And she turned to him and said something that changed the course of history. I was having lunch with her in Connecticut about 30 years ago. I said, how'd you ever think that answer, Lois? My God, she said, it was so obvious. She said, when he said, not one person has stayed sober. And she said, you did. Oh, yeah. That's why old timers don't have much hair in front. You just go through life going, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So he went down to talk to Dr. Towns, or the doctor of the Towns Hospital. And they said, you know, Bill, you're doing it wrong. You're preaching Oxford group religion to these guys. What you got to offer them is knowing how they feel and that you did the same thing. He said, oh. So he accepted that. So by the time he got out to Akron, Ohio and talked to this drunken doctor, he didn't talk to him about his spiritual values at all, talking about his feelings. And the doctor stayed sober for 2 weeks, got drunk again, because they'd been discussing spiritual values. And after the doctor got drunk again, Bill remembered, I didn't stay sober by discussing spiritual values, I discovered by trying to help people. So they got somebody up in the hospital there to call on, as we all know. And I heard him talk many, many years ago, 40 years ago or so. He said, I was laying in that bed in Akron. And I'm a lawyer from St. Louis, moved up there to get away from my drinking. Of course, I didn't. He said, but my wife came in and said, there's two guys who want to talk to me about my drinking. And I told her, I'm not going to talk to anybody else about it. I'm so sick of sermons. I'm so sick of telling me how to do it by people who don't understand it all. I'm not going to do it. But he said, my wife's a pretty strong woman. So I talked to those two fellas. And they never talked to me about my drinking once. They never talked to me about my... They talked about their drinking and how they felt. And I never heard anybody describe me that well before in my life. I couldn't believe it. I was so impressed. I stayed with those fellas and I've been with them ever since. He became number three. The whole chain of Alcoholics Anonymous is predicated, our stuff is good, but unless you can get it through that wall, it means nothing. And what makes Alcoholics Anonymous work is that sometimes the man in his iron armor hears something, and, my God, And little by little, identification is what makes Alcoholics Anonymous work. The fact of one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic, not a counselor, not a teacher, not a psychiatrist, somebody that's saying, I know how you feel. That's an amazing thing. And that is why in 1958 or thereabouts, a man I knew well named Jim Willis, who was a gambler, he was an alcoholic and a gambler, and he would bring his gambling friends into AA because he was staying sober and he wanted them to get off gambling. He said, we don't want to go there and listen to those goddamn juicers. That's not my problem. He said, wait, I got an idea. And he wrote to New York, and he became the first one to get permission to use the 12 steps out of AA, and he founded Gamblers Anonymous so that gamblers would have a place to go and identify. And it really took off. It still is the largest of all the non-AA 12-step movements. And he became very, very successful. I remember I played the piano in a little dance band at their second anniversary. The dance had a good time and people doing great. And by 1964 or thereabouts, Jim was just, he was like the Bill Wilson. His pictures in the meetings, and people just loved him and people were getting off track gambling. He really didn't have time for AA anymore. So people were quite sad when he got drunk and died. But nobody ever gambled again. And that's why some people in North Hollywood would bring in their narcotic addict friends to meetings where there was no identification, then got permission to use the 12 steps and form Narcotics Anonymous so that addicts would have a place to go and identify. Recovery is the same, but it's the identification to get them in that mood. Then some guys out by where I live in the early 1960s got permission to use the 12 steps and formed Cocaine Anonymous. And about 1959, a lady that I got to know, who was an overeater, used the 12 steps to form Overeaters Anonymous. And these are the big four of the non-AA. And they're only formed for one reason. The steps for recovery are always the same. It's just, are you identifying, is this for a narcotic or an alcoholic? And I really never understood what they made such a big deal about. When I was about 2 years sober, I'd been slipping for 10 years. I was so surprised to be sober, and I still had no front teeth. I weighed about 130 pounds. But I was on fire, boy. I was sober 2 years. And I was talking in a meeting one night in the club on obsessions, not the recovery from them. I didn't know about that, but I knew about the obsessions. And this plump woman came up to me and she said, that's so interesting. I never heard anybody talk about those. I have founded a group called Overeaters Anonymous. Would you come over and talk to our ladies on Sunday? I said, sure. I weighed a skinny little scrawny thing. I'll show them. So I went over there and talked to these ladies, about eight plump ladies sitting around a table. And I gave a good talk on the obsessions, and they were just wonderful. Then they had a little sharing session, and I couldn't believe my ears. Woman over here, her son had just had his 10th birthday that week. He went to a military school down in Long Beach. She sent her husband down to get him, and she took out the cake and iced it and prepared for him to come back. I thought, I hope the cake is good. Took a little bite and another little bite. By the time I got back, the cake was gone. And she felt so sad. And they all felt bad for her. I didn't say anything because I'm too nice a guy, but I wanted to say, just have a piece of cake and forget it, for Christ's sake. What's wrong with you? Yeah. Woman over here talked about eating ice cream. As soon as her husband goes to work, she goes to the store and gets ice cream and eats it and eats it. She says, I don't feel good unless I'm eating. And I didn't say anything. I'm a nice guy. I wanted to say, no wonder you're fat, for Christ's sake, eating ice cream. Woman over here was my favorite. She ate till she couldn't eat anymore, then put her finger down her throat and vomited so she could eat some more. I thought, Jesus, don't bother shaking hands with me after the meeting, slimy fingers. I mean, I can see doing that for drinking, but not eating. I've done it for drinking a lot. Late Saturday afternoon, God, the sun's still up. What was the difference? I'm a smart guy. I understood exactly what they're saying, but I didn't identify. It was just strange behavior, which is the same thing we get from our families when we try to describe alcoholism to them. They want to understand, but they can't really. They never will, because it doesn't go boom to them. And so the focal spot of Alcoholics Anonymous makes it work is one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. And that is why again and again over the years, we talk about the primary purpose. Our primary purpose is to carry the message to the alcoholic, not because they're different, better, worse, anyone else, but because I can get through maybe to that wall where no one in the world can get through except another alcoholic. So I guess if that's the case, maybe we should remember to keep our efforts of you must be an alcoholic to be an Alcoholics Anonymous member. Because without that, it's just information. And information never kept any alcoholic sober, ever, a long time. So maybe in that case, better remember, Alcoholics Anonymous is made up of alcoholics. And if you're in a group where they have non-alcoholics speak, you are doing your newcomer a disservice. You are doing him a disservice. The only purpose of the meeting is to get new people there so they can hear the story that they thought they were the only ones that had. That's why they first had the meetings in Akron, so they could prove to their newcomer there were actually other people staying sober. So, the second thing under consideration, of course, is the Big Book. The Big Book's a nice book, but it is kind of old-fashioned, and it isn't really written in a sparkling style. I remember when I first tried to get sober, a long time ago, my sponsor had me read the book. Now I'm a writer. I read it. And they all say it's a badly written book. It isn't. It isn't badly written. It's just endlessly dull. 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 Some years later, when I came off Skid Row, and my new sponsor said, read the book. And I said, I read the book. So I didn't say it so well. I didn't have any front teeth. I read the book. He said, well, God damn it, read it again. And I read it again, and I realized I had misjudged it the first time. It was even duller than I remembered. Yeah. I wrote things like, buy this product, take this action, blah, 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 blah. And you read this book looking for a little excitement. If you are thorough at this stage of your development, you'll... So I just gave up on the damn book. And I got a sponsor who was instructed me on a lot of things in AA, and later on I found them all in the book, and I gave the book another chance. But the book has been around for a long time, written with the, you know, they say the book is a miracle. And you make, that should send questions in your mind. What do you mean miracle? Of all the words in the English language, miracle is more often misused in AA than anything. What's a miracle? Heard a guy a few years ago, he said, I got up early this morning, they looked at an eastern sky, and the sun was rising, and I said, Betty, it's a miracle. I've been given another day of sobriety. Oh, crap. Get up early tomorrow and have another one, you boob. Yeah. Miracles are supposed to be inexplicable, ununderstandable. What's so ununderstandable about this book? Well, first of all, it was written by a guy that didn't know enough to write it. 3 years sober, no background in psychology, abnormal psychology, medicine. Most of the people around him in the fellowship were drinking. Most of them, we forget that, you know. That first issue of the book, which we think it was the Bible of our book, and the stories in the back, most of them drank again. Not because they were bad, I don't think, but because maybe I think at that time what a lot of them thought, it's like pneumonia. Once you get better, you're all right again. He didn't realize it was an ongoing thing. But he was 3 years sober to write this book. And if you're new tonight, you might say, or this afternoon, you might say, well, Jesus, 3 years sober? You should have known enough to write a book by then. Well, when you get to be 3 years sober, you'll realize you don't know enough to write a book. By the time you're 5 years sober, you just try to be nice to people 3 years sober. Hang in there, Jimmy. You're doing a good job. By the time you're 10 years sober, you hate to send people 3 years sober to get your coffee, you know. Was that two creams and one sugar, or two sugars and one cream? Or I'll do it, for Christ's sake. By the time you're 20 years sober, you hate to have people 3 years sober unattended on your property. I want to see how they turn out before I trust them. And this guy wrote this book for the worst of motives. He had no motive to help his fellow man. They were trying to raise enough money to build an alcoholic hospital, which if built would have destroyed us. But he wrote this book, and he wrote everything he knew, and he put down things that he could see and he could sense. And some of the great things about the book, though, that always strike me. For example, the 12 promises. Every self-help book has things that's going to do wonderful for you. You're going to become rich and famous. And sure. In this book, you're going to lose your financial home. You're going to think of grades. You're going to be fine. Yeah. And most of these things hadn't happened to Bill yet. What the hell was he writing about? And yet, every one of those things come too true if you stay here long enough and do the things. They don't last very often because we're such self-willed pukes that we have to screw it up. Oh, it's getting pretty good today. How can we screw it up today? You know. But they come. The closest I ever came to disbelieving, I was about 5 years sober, and my family had returned to me all of a sudden. And instead of living a carefree life of a bachelor in Hollywood, I had a bunch of kids and dogs and cats and expenditures I couldn't keep up with, and I called my sponsor. I said, Chuck, I'm doing the best I can, but, you know, those promises, those financial insecurity will leave you. I'm getting in deeper and deeper. He said, no, son. It says, fear of financial insecurity will leave you. Good luck. But they all have come true, and they come to me again and again. I find myself when I'm out of self from time to time for brief periods, I really feel quite well. And they've worked for me for over half a century, so I know they work. But the theory of the book is, they still have part of them all that. But what does it do? What does it do? What's the big deal in the book? I'll tell you this, what the book is. It is not a narrative of recovery. The stories are in the back, but not the book. The book, in last analysis, it's like a cookbook. A cookbook for emotional problems. And it gives you answers how to handle various things. And people study the book and say, but I still feel crappy. That's like studying a cookbook and saying, I understand every recipe in here. Why am I still starving? Because you haven't cooked the goddamn food, that's why. Book studiers have a tendency to get so busy with the book they haven't got time to do what it says. I haven't got time to go for a newcomer. I got to study how it works. You know. What makes it so remarkable is that the book, the reason it's a miracle, apart from all these reasons, is this, and partially because of these reasons. In the last 69 years, this book has changed more alcoholic lives of our type than all other therapies combined in the history of mankind. You know what that is? That's a miracle. And I would not want to be the one to change it based on a newcomer with 20 minutes experience of sobriety telling me how it should be done. People say, do you think we should change the book? No. Now, let's get this straight before tonight. This is the signal for spontaneous applause. And this is the signal for choked sobs. Anyway, the book is designed to enable people like us, with the aid of someone enabling us to break through that wall so we can see what we can identify, and to take actions that eventually change our lives and continue to take them. Continue to take them. I was pleased today listening to Eva talk about, she talks about still taking these actions. And some of them don't do it anymore, and they're gone away. I used to sponsor a nice lady in Squim for years and years, and she stopped taking them. She went to church and got sick and died. I don't think it stopped, actually, but her life went to hell all of a sudden, as far as I could know. But I watched it again and again, watch people who have, they never realized that for us to stop taking these actions is like a diabetic to stop taking insulin. I don't need it anymore. I've taken it for 10 years and I'm feeling great. Okay, just stop for a year and see what happens, pal. So I think the book is really a tremendous thing. And I, whenever people come to me and say that they think this should be changed, I say, why don't you write out what you should be changed? Show me how you're going to change it. Then we'll talk. And they never come back. And in 1970 or 2010, 2000, I'm getting a little, who are you? What are you doing? Why are you stalking me? That's one thing good about being old. You meet new people every morning. Uh-huh. I'm married to you. Are you sure? Yeah. But it's an interesting thing. It's written perhaps in a style that is not wonderful, but until someone shows me a way that works better, boy, I'm going to stick with it. I'm going to defend it to the hilt. In 2000, or about two, I guess it was 2000, maybe it was, I don't know, Eva, when they again brought up the idea of changing the book. Someone brought it in to the conference, let's change the book. And they had a discussion, and thank God, they said, okay, we'll change the book, but not the first 164 pages. We'll move the stories around and put in some new stories and take out some old stories and change Dr. Paul's title. But the 164 pages are inviolate. So I for one, would be very much against changing the book, no matter how good your reasons were, until you show me something that works better. The third thing I want to talk about briefly today is the Lord's Prayer. I do not know why people take such umbrage at the Lord's Prayer. It's becoming so politically correct. Oh, that's Jesus' prayer. When Jesus, they say, it offends our Jewish friends. It offends Muslims, as if anybody cares about them, for Christ's sake. But but we don't want to offend Muslim alcoholics either, or any other types of alcoholics. Why is that they're so concerned? And why do we say the Lord's Prayer anyway? And by an odd coincidence, I just happen to have the reason in my pocket. A letter from Bill Wilson, dated April 14th, 1959, taken from our archives. Now about this business of adding the Lord's Prayer to each AA meeting. This practice probably came from the Oxford groups who were influential in the early days of AA. You've probably noted in AA Comes of Age what the connection of these people with AA really was. I think saying the Lord's Prayer was a custom of theirs following the close of each meeting. Therefore, it got shifted into general usage among us. Of course, there are always those who seem to be offended by its introduction of any prayer whatever in an ordinary AA gathering. Also, it is sometimes complained that the Lord's Prayer is a Christian document. Nevertheless, this prayer is of such widespread use and recognition that the argument of its Christian origin seems to be a little far-fetched. It is also true that AAs believe in some kind of God and that communication and strength is attainable through His grace. Since this is the general consensus, it seems only right that at least the Serenity Prayer and the Lord's Prayer be used in connection with our meetings. It does not seem necessary to defer to the feelings of our agnostic and atheist newcomers to the extent of completely hiding our light under a bushel. However, around here, the leader of the meeting usually asks those to join him in the Lord's Prayer who feels they would like to do so. The worst thing that happens is to the objectors is that they have to listen to it. This is doubtless a salutary exercise in tolerance at their stage of progress. Good. Because I know of nothing in the Lord's Prayer, that is not in the 12 steps. Really, there's nothing there. Now, my home group, some of you know this, some of you have been members of it, the Pacific Group, now the largest successful A group in the world. Almost 1,000 people get together every Wednesday night. It's held in a big synagogue. That's the only place we can hold it. From time to time, the rabbi comes and sits in the back seat to listen. And he has told me on the phone, I wish I could get my people in that synagogue like you get your people in that synagogue. But I notice when we say the Lord's Prayer, he jumps up and holds hands and says the Lord's Prayer. And I think, how could it be offensive to a guy who's went to Yom Kippur once in the last 2 years when the rabbi himself says the Lord's Prayer? But they do. They just like to stir up crap. A lot of people do that. And I should put it more nicely, but that's what it really boils down to. And you often think, you know, Jesus was not a Christian when he gave the prayer. He was a Jewish rabbi. He only became a Christian later after he reread it. I suppose, I don't know. But you could, to the best of my knowledge, there are only 3 meetings in Australia that say the Lord's Prayer. There are very few in Europe that say the Lord's Prayer because they've been told it offends people. But I'll tell you, if people can't sit through the Lord's Prayer, how the hell are they going to do anything else around here? That is just so innocuous, it seems odd. And when I hear people in our group talk about, let's stop saying the Lord's Prayer, I say, why don't you go form your own group and say whatever you want to? And they say, because you use the Serenity Prayer, that's not religious. Oh? Here's the Serenity Prayer as it appeared in a magazine in 1935, written by Reinhold Niebuhr. And this is what the Serenity Prayer said. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Living one day at a time, enjoying one moment at a time, accepting hardship as the pathway to peace, taking as Jesus did this sinful world as it is, not as I would have it. Trusting that Jesus will make all things right is surrender to his will, that I may be reasonably happy in this life and supremely happy with him forever in the next. Amen. Now that's what I call a religious prayer. But anyway, you probably never heard that before, did you? But that's why, I mean, I guess any group can do what they want. It's very nice, individual, we can do what we want in the fourth tradition. But I would certainly hope that you would not be a leader in trying to get rid of the Lord's Prayer, which has served well for 74 years and has helped an awful lot of people. And the last thing I'm going to talk about is anonymity. Why is the big need for anonymity? We have nothing to hide anymore. What's wrong with saying I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous? And it really is a nice testament. And I think a lot of people don't understand. They say we no longer need the protection. That might very well be true. Maybe we don't need the protection. But over the years, since it was written in 1945, it has gradually evolved into something else. It has gradually evolved from a protection against them knowing, against it becomes a protection against our ego, ourselves, as an individual. The last letter Bill Wilson ever wrote is he's dying. Dealt with the need of anonymity to maintain that spiritual connection. Now, when you say, well, what happens if you break your tradition? Some people do that. And they do it. I don't think God says, oh, there's a person that broke his traditions. Let's get him. Whap. You know. But I got into this early, 1959. There was a woman in California who wrote a book called I'll Cry Tomorrow, a woman named Lillian Roth, who's a famous singer. And she wrote in her book that she was a member of AA. Her sponsor said, I wish you would do that, Lillian. Oh, she said, no. When people discover that Lillian Roth is a member of AA, they'll want to come. It isn't a bunch of old guys in dark back overcoats. So she put it in there and really did well. And a couple years later, when Lillian Roth was laying face down in her own puke in Palm Springs, I don't know what people thought about AA then, but probably not much. The next year, John Barrymore's daughter was an alcoholic, and she wrote a book called Too Much Too Soon, and I read that. And in there, she took it a step further beyond Lillian Roth. She'd gone to AA and was now able to have wine with dinner. I kept reading that. I thought, there must be, maybe I can find out how this is done. But before I found out, she died in the Malibu drunk tank, so it didn't make much difference. I've watched person after person break their anonymity for personal reasons over the years. I have never seen one person profit from it. And I don't think God is punishing them. I don't think it's that causing that at all. I have a theory, it may or may not be right, but I think anonymity, now let me explain it first of all, to some of you may not know what anonymity is. Because of the nature of my work in Los Angeles and what I do, I'm in the paper every so often and I'm on television and radio a lot. And they always talk to me as a recovering or recovered alcoholic, which is all right, because that's what I am. That's no break of anonymity. Break of anonymity when I mention Alcoholics Anonymous or that I might be a member. Then you cannot use your name, then you cannot use your face, then you can't, it has to be anonymous. There can be nothing in self-aggrandizement. I have years, in the mid-1960s, alcoholism was still not very well known, and they'd get a bunch of us to go over in different times to go to the radio and talk on the radio, and then my name was Alcoholic Al. One day, at KHWZ, guy was saying to me, he said, Al, you mean to say that you committed suicide then and had to be brought back to life to be put in the insane asylum? And I said, sure, I just said it, I wasn't surprised. And he had big tears in his eyes. He said, gosh, Al, you're the first person I've ever met who really tried to kill himself. And I'd been in AA too long by that time. I said, Jesus, you're the first guy I ever met that didn't. You know, everybody I know. What kind of life is it without thinking about suicide once in a while? But, and when you're on screen, you can't go on screen. You can't, I don't know if you, you remember that thing they did in 2000, that hour-long show they did on AA? You remember that? You, speaker, Eva. They had A&E did an hour-long special on Alcoholics Anonymous, and they had four people on there discussing AA anonymously. Perhaps now you recognize me. And it was really good, very interesting, very good, good thing. But in order to be fair, they had some woman on there who'd written a book about how you don't need Alcoholics Anonymous if you go, what is that, recovery? Rational recovery, what is it? Huh? Moderation management. She is from up here somewhere, wasn't she? And they showed her, she said, yes, I no longer need Alcoholics Anonymous, I have moderation management, and in our organization we are fine. And thank God she didn't last long, I mean, it went by, but it kind of cheered us all up when we discovered that by the time the show aired, she was on the way to prison for vehicular manslaughter, because while drunk, she killed some people in a crosswalk. And her last recorded words were, I'm going back to AA someday. And I thought to myself, gee, we'll be waiting for you with open arms, you puke. I don't judge her, though. I don't find that necessary. But anonymity is when you use your name or your likeness and mention that Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is a... But the reason for anonymity, I think, when you maintain it, it keeps your ego in check. One of the things that killed the Washingtonians were these terrible terrible fights that people had to be the most famous. And you don't ever get to be famous here. You're still just a first name and initial. That's all you ever are. And when people jump, you're under kind of a, almost like a tent, and you're safe under the tent. But these people want to break their anonymity. They get above the tent. I'm going to show that I'm more important. I don't need AA's help anymore. I'm going to help AA. I'm going to say that a big shot like me is a member of AA, and that's going to help them. And that's all very nice, but eventually trouble comes, and they never seem to have any place to turn. They never seem to be able to get back under the tent. And sooner or later, down they go, again and again and again and again. So it seems to me that maintenance of anonymity is certainly a small price to pay to stay under the tent. All in all, when you think about all the changes coming, being discussed, why should you be an alcoholic? Because that's how Alcoholics Anonymous works. Why should we not change this book? Because this book works. Why should we say the Lord's Prayer? Because they've been saying it since 1935, and everybody you admire said it, and it didn't seem to hurt them. And finally, why should I remain anonymous? Because I want to stay in the tent. So I guess when you title it, put in the program for my talk today, where do we go from here? I don't know where we go from here on some things, but on those four things, I think we're right where we belong. Thank you.